to the Poetic Justice Dialogue Series. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and my dialogue today is a bit unique in that it's part of a special series I'll be conducting over the next couple months focused on gender and sexuality. And these dialogues are meant to offer an in-depth taste for some of the topics that will be covered in my upcoming book entitled Integral Voices on Sex, Gender, and Sexuality, Critical Inquiries, which is going to be published with SUNY Press next month. I'm the co-editor of this book alongside Dr. Sarah Nicholson, and our book includes 13 contributors with chapters ranging from feminism to the men's movement, LGBTQ issues, and sexuality education in the 21st century. So if you want to learn more about the book, you can also find information on my website. My dialogue today will be with friend and colleague Diane Musho-Hamilton, with whom I've co-written a chapter entitled Evolving Our Approach to Sexual Harassment, A New Role for Women. So just a bit about Diane first. She's an exceptionally gifted mediator, group facilitator, and Zen teacher. She was the first director of the Office of Alternative Dispute Resolution for the Utah Judiciary, where she established mediation programs throughout the court system. And she's the recipient of several prestigious awards for her work in the area of conflict resolution. Diane's also a practitioner of meditation for almost 30 years, and in 2003 she received ordination as a Zen monk. She brings decades of experience in conflict resolution to address the challenges of our modern day experience with an uncommon spiritual perspective. And on a more personal note, I've known Diane for about 8 or 9 years now, I think, around that long. And I've always appreciated her incredibly wise and compassionate presence, as well as her unique approach to dealing with the more difficult aspects of conflict and difference and tension that are just central to our relationship, our experience of relationship as human beings. And that to me is a really especially important gift to bring to the highly charged and often conflicted discussions around sex and gender, including the topic we're going to talk about today. So Diane, I just want to start by welcoming you to my dialogue series. It's a real pleasure to have you here, and I always enjoy our conversations. So I'm looking forward to this one.
Thank you, Vanessa. I really appreciate your invitation, and it was a mind-expanding experience to co-write this chapter with you, and I appreciate that you included me. And I think just for the listeners to understand that my interest in this conversation really comes from kind of three sources. The first is just my own being a woman and just the challenges and that I've experienced in relationship with men and with other women around issues related to sexuality. And then my background as a mediator, there was a period of time where I mediated quite a few cases related to sexual harassment issues and actually formed quite a strong relationship with some HR people and started working within organizations to help men and women to work these situations out before they became litigation. And then the final, of course, is just to be involved in an integral conversation, bringing both a developmental perspective and an integral lens to, quote, this, in this case, sexual harassment, and seeing kind of what evolves when we work with this whole challenge using what we've learned from the integral map. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, and it was definitely a unique conversation for me too, and so I'm excited to share it with people.
Great.
So our chapter itself, I just want to give a bit of context because our chapter itself is broken into two parts. The first half deals more with the evolution of sexual harassment law and policy as it's developed specifically in North America over the last 60 years and the impacts that that has had, you know, on our relationships as males and females and our sexual relationships, both in positive and negative ways. The second half of the chapter focuses more on kind of an intimate and immediate exploration of our experience as women in the sexual realm and our experience of power and powerlessness in that realm and how we can create more consciousness and clarity in that dimension of our lives. And we decided for this call, Diane and I decided we'd focus more specifically on the inquiry that's the focus of the second half of the chapter and leave the more scholarly inquiry about sexual harassment policy for people to read when the chapter comes out. We mainly decided this because we wanted a bit more of a vulnerable discussion about some of the challenges and opportunities facing us as women in relation to our sexuality at this particular moment in history, of course, speaking of the West. And it's also important to frame it that our inquiry is meant to empower women with new tools. It's not meant to blame them for sexual harassment or sexual exchanges that went wrong. We both think men and women have a huge amount of work to do in this area, and neither sex has really been taught the skills, in any meaningful way as we've grown up to relate to our sexuality in a really conscious way. So we're both women, so we felt we have that experience to bring, and, you know, we can speak to that vulnerable side of that part of the topic. And I will give some of the bare bones of history before we start talking just on sexual harassment policy, because it will give some context for our discussion today.
And Vanessa, just one thing that I would like to add too for the listener is that some of the trends that we're going to be talking about in terms of intimacy or power, powerlessness, they can certainly be related with in same-sex relationships or transgendered relationships, but we are mainly focusing on the dynamics between men and women and what happens in the erotic realm when men and women interact. So just to give a tip of the hat to that as well.
Absolutely. And is there any other context you wanted to add? Or there's going to be lots of qualifiers we're going to try to make.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, throughout the dialogue to not, you know.
It's just interesting to note how much we have to prepare before we can just kind of, you know, sort of open up the conversation, because there's a lot that has to be taken into account. I think for me, what's most important is that Vanessa and I, and we're very much interested in using a developmental model. So everything is developmentally contextualized, meaning that one assertion that is really correct in a certain time and place on another part of the planet is not the right move at all, because that, you know, another culture, another time is in terms of how relationships are evolving, you know, there's a different cutting edge. So trying to hold this whole conversation within the context of development is really one of the things that I think we both aspire to, but it's not that easy.
No, it's really hard, and we will at times have to make certain generalizations, and we'll do our best, you know, to qualify. But I think it's important, like, I think also the kind of nervousness we have about talking about some of these things also speaks to the particular moment we're in. That's interesting too. So I think we're going to dive into that and just see where that takes us. So just to give a bit of context on sexual harassment policy, and Diane, feel free to jump in if you want to add
anything.
We'll do. So sexual harassment was first recognized in 1964 in the Civil Rights Act, and it was first recognized as a form of sex discrimination, and this was part of a lot of anti-discrimination initiatives that were happening at the time. It took a while for sexual harassment policy to catch on and become part of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, and then part of the law. And it really was in the 1980s that ushered in an expansion of the legal definition of sexual harassment, both in the workplace and academic environments, and an expansion of the breadth of litigation that was possible under this particular law. So our chapter really looks at both the positive benefits that have come out of the institution of sexual harassment policy, obviously the increased rights and respect for women in the workplace and society as a whole. The way, you know, before these policies were in place, women could be raped by their employers without repercussion. And, you know, this was really important for helping women get into the workplace. So we explored that positive side, and then we also explore the shadow side of what feminist Daphne Bataille calls the sexual harassment industry, both in workplace and academic settings, which as of more recently, we argue, has limited some of the possibilities of both men and women's fullest empowerment by fostering a heightened sense of victimization around women's sexuality and a need to protect women, and increasing issues of men facing undue process in sexual harassment charges. We also look at this within the context of how the definition of sexual harassment has become increasingly broad and even ambiguous over the last few decades due to the incorporation of the hostile environment category of sexual harassment. So we're just going to briefly define quid pro quo sexual harassment and hostile environment harassment, because it's important for this dialogue. Diane, do you want to just say quickly what quid pro quo sexual harassment is?
Yeah, quid pro quo is basically an exchange where someone's given a promotion in exchange for sexual favors. You know, the basic, you know, something for something.
Right. Yeah, so there could be a demand for sexual favors in return for advancement, or a threatening of a loss of position if someone doesn't comply with demands. And that was really the first sexual harassment policy that was instituted. And most feminists are pretty behind this one. Most everyone is pretty behind this one. The hostile environment.
And I think it's also often what people think of when they think about sexual harassment. They don't necessarily think in terms of this broader category that you're going to talk about now.
Exactly, yeah. So hostile environment harassment, it came around later, and it was more a bit more ambiguously defined, but it was meant to encompass all the situations in the workplace where an employee might be subject to, you know, some kind of exposure to verbal or visual or sexual gestures that were experienced as disturbing or offensive or stressful. So this could include hearing sexual jokes, being exposed to pornographic images, or even receiving repeated invitations for an unwanted date. This increasingly broad and often ambiguous definition, it brought new challenges in assessing sexual harassment cases, particularly because of the amount of subjectivity involved in interpreting what makes a hostile environment, and because it puts more minor sexual harassment offenses on the same spectrum as rape. They're seen as different categories on one spectrum, and this ends up creating an environment where minor offenses can pick up the stigma of rape. So these are some of the challenges that are facing the sexual harassment, you know, industry, if we called it that. So let's just dive in. Diane, you say in the chapter that the law itself, I mean, it's focused on changing the exterior dimension of social policy. It's a way to regulate human behaviors, and that's important. But you also say that law is deeply interpretive, and it's informed and shaped by the values and consciousness of a given culture at any particular time. And this also, laws develop and they change. It takes time for that to happen, and this can sometimes lag behind the faster changing values of a culture, which also creates problems. The problem of subjectivity in law becomes especially difficult, we both say, when it comes to relationships and sexuality, because there are so many gray areas and miscommunication. So maybe a good way to start, I'd love to hear just some of the ways you see the challenge of subjectivity and interpretation showing up in sexual harassment cases, maybe that you've worked on as a mediator, but also just more generally as you've witnessed men and women relating to each other in the interpersonal and sexual domain. That's a good place to start.
Yeah, great. Well, I think it's important to note that sexual harassment as a legal category is useful in the context of, or is applied in the context of our work relationships. So then, you know, basically there is both how it is we behave with one another and then what our interior relationships, what our values are, what our, you know, feelings are, what our private thoughts are, and what of those we choose to share with one another. So in the context of mediation, one way in which subjectivity has comes to play that can be quite problematic is, let's take an example, for instance, where two colleagues at work, and let's imagine that there's no power differential. So it isn't a matter of somehow somebody either bestowing favors or advancement or somebody receiving favors or advancement, just two colleagues working together. Let's imagine for a moment that they're both single, so there's not necessarily an ethical problem in terms of their other relationships, but just who simply find that they are, you know, that starts to develop a kind of eroticized quality between the two of them. Maybe they're both enjoying it, and maybe that ripens into a full-blown relationship, and as long as things go well, there's really no problem, you know, because there's nothing that precludes people, particularly people who are in the same power roles in a workplace, from, you know, now everybody knows that on a practical level, as soon as something starts to go awry in the relationship, this is when often problems emerge. So I worked on a lot of cases in which the relationship started out sort of balanced and open, but because of misunderstandings or rejection or, you know, whatever it is that arises between couples, at a certain period of time, they no longer are happy with one another. Or maybe it starts to affect the way they're conducting their work. And then all of a sudden, as soon as the trouble starts to emerge from an emotional perspective, from this deeply subjective domain of experience, then quickly is when you start to see a lot of blame starting to arise, and what was a positive experience becomes a negative one. So in my experience, lots of times it's when it moves from being a positive experience to a negative experience. And when that negativity sets in, then there's a need to blame someone. And then all of a sudden there's this whole question of who did what and who caused this enormous problem. So the work that I did, both as a mediator, but also in working in organizations, helping people who had, you know, somehow fallen into an eroticized zone with each other, helping to straighten that out so that it didn't turn into a complaint or litigation. If that, does that make sense?
Yeah, and you noticed there was, when lawyers got involved, it became more difficult often.
Yeah, well, once lawyers are involved, money is involved. Right. So once it becomes illegal, it's legalized, and one party is suing another party, it just is a whole different animal at that point. Now, keep in mind that organizations themselves have liability. So it isn't just simply that two parties can get in trouble with each other. What happens is the employer themselves are in danger of a hostile work environment. So we're looking at not just party A, party B, you know, woman, man, but we're also looking at the responsibility of the organization to maintaining an environment that's basically free of sexualized interaction. And particularly, this is where it gets tricky too. We talk about this in the article, is that what starts to happen is that we start to frame all sexual exchange or eroticized exchange as unwanted, because from the perspective of the employer, it's risky. It's too risky. So then we find ourselves in environments in which any expression of eroticized energy is just simply off limits, which becomes quite puritanical. So there's a certain kind of oppression that sets in. So it's a very dicey territory for everybody.
This is interesting too. And it does apply. There's some differences with academic settings, but there is a lot of crossover. What I found interesting was I read an article recently, and I can't remember the exact statistic, but something like 40% of people meet their partners in the workplace, like their
precisely.
Future partners, right?
That's so, precisely the problem.
So this is a real, yeah.
I met my partner at the workplace. In fact, right. There was a big power difference between us. My husband was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and I was employed by the administrative office. So we were colleagues, but technically he was the administrator, the chief administrator of the judiciary. So technically he was my boss, even though he was four or five levels removed from me.
Right. And this is true in colleges too. You know, we meet partners.
Yeah.
And so yeah, that adds an extra dimension of difficulty.
Yeah, it does.
So maybe, you know, one of the things, so just for some context, I mean, there's a lot of debates happening on both sides of this issue. And I think, you know, if I were to make some general framings of the two sides, there's, you know, the side that is looking more for increased protection of women. And even, you know, there's feminists that go so far as wanting, you know, that every exchange has to be consented on in every way when it comes to, you know, sexual exchange, you know, and it just gets more and more difficult to have a spontaneous interaction.
Mm-hmm.
The other side, you know, and the other argument for the limits of that is it does in a way infantilize the woman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It does
yeah.
actually make her kind of unable to regulate her own sexuality or to redirect energy she doesn't want.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are instances where it is out of her control, but I would say in the kind of situations we're talking about and these more ambiguous situations, there's a lot to be said for our own ability to empower ourselves around how we relate to sexuality in our environment. So I guess, you know, there's these two sides, one that argues women need to take more responsibility, one that women are, you know, in need of more protection. And I guess this would be a good place to flesh out what would be the integral perspective, if we were to call it that. What would be maybe a way of bridging these two divides that have been contested in the feminist world?
Well, again, I think this is where just a simple developmental perspective can be extremely helpful. You and I talked earlier this week about just a horrible story on the internet this week of two young girls in India, just young girls. They were, I don't know, 9 and 12, maybe something like that, who had been raped and who were subsequently hanged for being sexually violated by their own community, by their own family. You know, so on one end of the spectrum, protection of women, absolutely. I mean, this is an environment in which, you know, first of all, they're completely abused and violated, and then they're actually murdered for that. So that's just untenable at the extreme end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you know, we have women who engage fully in, you know, sexual or romantic relationships or eroticized relationships, and then for whatever reason suddenly are making accusations of date rape or accusations of sexual harassment. And, you know, I think there are many, and you can talk about this, Vanessa, yourself for a minute, but there are many instances in which the reputation of a man is completely ruined. His life is, you know, people have lost positions in universities, positions in other organizations, with absolutely nothing like due process, you know, or even an evidence-based process of any kind. So we've got, you know, really, you know, a full spectrum of violations in all directions. And then, you know, we're basically arguing that looking at this all through a developmental lens is helpful, and realizing the place where we can develop and grow is in our own interior and our own understanding, and the extent to which we become more mature, more self-regulating, more aware of both our capacity to receive and the agentic side of our sexuality, because both men and women have the capacity to initiate, and we both have the capacity to receive. So the idea that, you know, I fundamentally disagree with the idea that a woman has no agency, but that's, you know, North America, you know, 2014. Is that true in India right now? Possibly not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, like, we were talking earlier about, you know, because I've been doing a lot of research on rape statistics and sexual harassment statistics. And there's, depending on which studies you look at, and there's a lot to be said on both sides. And, you know, people arguing that there's more unreported rapes, people arguing that false accusations of rapes aren't reported enough. And I think at the end of the day, like, all of this hashing out is important, you know, to try to get to the truth of what's going on. But as I was saying to you, I think the one thing, you know, at least one area we can do better at is really trying to develop ourselves in relation to each other and having more, you know, regard and respect for each other and taking more responsibility on ourselves as well. That will help us at least evolve the dynamics rather than just fighting about who's more at fault. And I think that that feels really important to me, having been in these debates for so long. Right. I really feel like we can fight endlessly. And it's not that we don't want to get at truth, but I do think in the situation we're in, again, developmentally, you know, in a particular time and place, we have that opportunity. And, you know, we do talk in the chapter also about, you know, you have to take into account issues of trauma background, issue of socioeconomic differences, power relationships. But even power relationships get tricky because, you know, you note in the chapter, and I think this is true, and I can speak to my own experience, we can speak to our own experience, that, you know, we are often also attracted to power as women, and that there's difficulties if we have a kind of unsaid quid pro quo going on with a powerful man that we're not aware of even or owning, that we're going to come up against ourselves and there's going to be confusion created. So I think all of these ways that, again, not to blame, but actually just to become more aware of ourselves is going to be helpful.
Well, you know, the question of the conditions, you know, the current conditions of the climate around these issues, one of the places where we have the most power, of course, is within, you know, our own interior, our own wakefulness, our own quality of consciousness. And lots of times, because we haven't really looked at, let's say, the patterning that we grew up with around sexual energy and what our relationship to it is and how we wield, receive, work with, or ignore, you know, the basic sexual capacity of our communications, we can be, as you're pointing out, more or less asleep. And so to learn how to kind of wake up, that each of us, you know, some of us are more expressive, some of us are more, you might say, neutralized. Some people are naturally wield more energy, have more charisma. And to personally be curious with yourself around what is your patterning, what are your strengths in those regards, what are some places where you might have blind spots, to become simply a more conscious being, you know, in terms of the power of your sexual communications or the erotic energy and how you work with it or whether you do and when you do or don't. And particularly that issue of not being conscious of it is really important. And I don't really think we can, my fundamental belief is that as women, we do have in North America, we do have power in that domain. it's important for us to acknowledge that, and with that power comes responsibility. And I think you and I are both arguing for women actually starting to participate as agents, both in the conversation and in the dynamics, taking more responsibility and also reacting in ways that are with more clarity and more compassion, as opposed to, you know, I work with a lot of young women today who are on the one hand disappointed when they're not approached by males, and on the other hand offended when they are. And that's a very kind of confusing situation that young women are kind of working with these days, that I've been asked to be helpful with more than once.
Definitely. And I think what might be helpful also is, I mean, we can look at our personal experience, and also the bigger context that might be helpful for depersonalizing it for some people is just, you know, the roles we've played as women historically in the West. We talk mm-hmm. in the chapter about 19th century, the ideas of femininity, the ideal feminine woman was someone who was, you know, like sexually neutral, and her sexual allure was actually her sexual neutrality. And she was kind of in need of protection from males who had been, you know, they had been sanctioned with all the dirty sexuality, you know? So mm-hmm. there's a way that we're inheriting all these ideas, you know, and it's not really personal at one level, you know, there's actually these deeper forces mm-hmm. and the unfortunate side of the shadow side of the feminist, movement in this regard, I think, is that it can actually reinforce that really traditional role, that kind of need to be protected. And again, of course, we're not saying there aren't times that you need to be protected, but it's that enforces our need to not actually have to look at these things really deeply, you know? And that's, and it's actually disempowering to us. I'm not even doing this for men. It's actually, you know, it's disempowering to me.
Yeah.
If I can't, you know, step more into that. So I think that's just all important to keep in perspective.
Well, I think, you know, some of the categories that you mentioned a moment ago. So, you know, women who are in environments where the abuse of women is just commonplace are in need of protection. You know, women who have abuse histories often need protection. People who are just more naive or young are in need of protection. Some women who have really deeply receptive natures and don't quite have the same ability to say no. You know, in other words, we're all to some degree, we need to take care of one another. You know, there are lots of women, and I haven't thought it through as much, but there are men who also probably need protection. But when that protection actually becomes, as we said earlier, infantilizing, or kind of takes us backwards, because instead of moving into owning more agency, we're sort of inadvertently regressing into, as you said, being somewhat powerless and neutralized. You know, Madonna is my age exactly. We're both in our mid-50s now. And one of the things about Madonna is one of the women who, in the, you know, pop culture scene, basically moved herself from being simply an object of other people's sexual pleasure to the agent of that. And she really took a stand for being a sexual agent and an object and owning both sides of that whole equation. And I think this is really important for us to actually, I think developmentally for lots of women, to own more consciously how much initiative we actually do take and do want to take for sexual exchange. That seems really important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do say in the chapter too that, you know, we have this legacy in the West, particularly of this very schizophrenic relationship to sexuality. Mm-hmm. We've got the kind of virgin whore, you know, complex, and this very, at one level, puritanical background, and then this very sexually expressive culture now. Mm-hmm. And trying to navigate that with a sense of consciousness is, you know, we're not taught the skills. As a young woman, I can say I wasn't taught the skills.
Absolutely.
You know?
I think that's right.
So we don't have a lot of models.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And in keeping in mind that women, in my mind, and you'd be able to help me more historically with this, but this sort of neutralizing of women's sexuality, they become the object of men, the more that they're simply, you know, the receivers of sexual attention as opposed to the initiators, that, you know, that particular stance was also good for males in another way. So if you're my wife and you're out in the world, I don't want you communicating any sexual intention because that's threatening to me. So, you know, it also, I mean, I think conventionally we could say it's a way patriarchy also had of kind of keeping women in line is to just deprive them of a sense that they should be sexual agents. And I think that's really problematic.
Yeah, I think both of those are true. And I'd also just add that there's also biological realities, you know, like some of them are just basically how we've evolved, you know, in relationship to agency and objectification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what worked for certain kinds of arrangements, you know, in our environments based on, mm-hmm. you know, sociobiological factors and technological factors. And
mm-hmm.
And that now is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the opportunity to actually to evolve and that we're on this edge to actually create more conscious
yeah.
relationships to all this. That's what is exciting.
Yeah, that's what's
know,
really exciting.
At one level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, you know, not to like go too deep or anything, but it would be neat to share some of our own experiences, I think, just to maybe get a bit more vulnerable about how we've experienced this. And then I'd love to actually just talk about building, you know, real practices we can use to build self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
to better create boundaries, recognize different forms of power in ourselves,
mm-hmm.
That might just, you know, assist women with starting this inquiry.
Yeah, great.
So yeah, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Go for it.
Okay. Before we had the call, I was thinking back to, you know, I've had a few interactions with powerful men that run into the category of sexual harassment. And I was thinking, you know, there's been different experiences. And I'd say when I was younger, that the experiences were a lot more difficult because I did feel less empowered. I felt
yeah.
people often had more economic or political power. I also felt that I just didn't have any idea how to deal with it. I had no idea,
yeah.
no idea what was going on. And I did
yeah.
think they carried a certain responsibility
yeah.
in that.
I agree.
As I've gotten older, I feel like it's interesting because I actually come from a background of more, you know, more of a trauma history. And I feel there was a certain moment in my life when I really realized when I could actually shift my identification
mm-hmm.
with victimization.
Mm-hmm.
I actually feel there was, that's why I see the complexity of this, because I do feel there
mm-hmm.
are certain things we need protection from when we just haven't built up certain resources in ourselves. Or
that's
we didn't
right,
get them
absolutely.
From our parents, you know?
I agree.
And then there was a moment when, after doing a lot of work on myself, where I actually could start seeing that my empowerment was coming by letting go of that need to be protected and letting
yeah.
go of that need to identify more as being the victim. And
mm-hmm.
so it's an interesting thing. I feel like I've experienced both sides of it. And now I actually consciously kind of relate when experiences like this happen to me, when I get into
mm-hmm.
sexual exchanges or whatever with people and suddenly something shifts in me and I feel like, oh my God, I don't know what to do, or I feel scared, or whatever it is, I really look at the situation, and there's been
mm-hmm.
times I've been able to totally flip it. So I think that's
mm-hmm.
really interesting.
Yeah, I think that is very interesting
yeah.
and important. Well, in terms of that in my own life, so I grew up with an aunt who was raped in the military. I grew up with another aunt who was sexually harassed in her workplace to the point that she had to quit. And she was a single mother, four children in the 60s. So that was terrible. And then, you know, just my own kind of encounters with, let's just say, males who are confused and males who are even aggressive and, you know, deliberately harassing. I had a boss one time who call me in the morning at the place where I worked before everybody arrived, and he didn't know that I knew it was him, but he would just make these really disgusting kind of sexual comments. For whatever reason, I always possessed a certain kind of personal power around saying no and turning away in such a way that I didn't feel like I was continually harassed. So I had success in being able to say no for some reason. I remember a specific incident when I was older, when I'd gone to work for the courts, and I went out, was invited to lunch by one of the older, well, very well-respected lawyer, and we had a conversation about some of the progress that we wanted to make with the committee we were on together, and then he took me back to the office, and as I went to get out, he sort of threw his arms around me, and I felt like I was in a scene from a movie in the 40s where he, you know, that I was dying to be ravished but resisting,
right.
And he was somehow, and I was like, wow, you know, like, Whoa.
Yeah.
Didn't see that coming, as they say. And you know, and just sort of saying to him like, hey, you know, not cool. And then just, you know, resuming our relationship after that and it being fine. And yet the experience of people not really feeling like they can say no, or really honestly just being really shaken up or traumatized by that. And so that there's that kind of play in there around just your own personal sense of power.
Yeah.
And your ability to respond congruently and powerfully to a situation like that. And what I'm hearing you say, Vanessa, is that you've experienced a shift in your own interior vis-a-vis those questions.
Yeah. And this, I think, plays into, you know, how we build self-awareness around this. Because I would actually say, I mean, it's shown up in the sexual domain, but I actually noticed that it has a lot to do with a building sense of self-confidence, of also not needing to be like acknowledged by men.
Mm-hmm.
So like I noticed that, you know, mm-hmm. you know, I think we gravitate as women toward powerful men. We want their affection. We want their regard, their acknowledgement for
yeah,
a lot
sure.
of different reasons. You know, and I know it goes the other way too for different reasons, but I won't go into men's experience on that. But I think, you know, me clarifying more like my own voice and where and not needing that kind of acknowledgement, regard, or at least being able to recognize
mm-hmm.
it when it shows up, has really been empowering to also not fall into these kind of situations
mm-hmm.
around sexuality. Because for me, sexuality was always kind of just part of that spectrum
yeah.
of how that showed
yeah.
up, you know. And I think for me, you know, as a younger woman, especially, you know, you get that easily, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can get that attention easily. And so when you don't feel other forms of power, sometimes that, yeah, it shows up. So I think for me, yeah, it's been about just be creating more awareness about what it is I'm wanting or not wanting from men,
mm-hmm.
And where those wants are coming from,
mm-hmm.
you know, thoughts that can come up even in the moment when like an exchange turns sexual, like just to notice the
mm-hmm.
thoughts, or,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to hurt him, or I don't know what to do. I'm flattered. And I also feel offended, you know, and just
mm-hmm.
often these things aren't really conscious for us.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's right.
So even by nature of making them conscious, I think we have more choice capacity. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree. And I think it's also important while we're, you know, because the point we're trying to make is the more we have these conversations, the more we explicate what our interior experience is, the more familiar we become. We look at our patterning, we look at our cultural context, literally more choice becomes available. And I'm thinking right now about a situation that I experienced at one point. Being in the circle of an older Mexican shaman, a Huichol Indian, who came and did an all-night ceremony. And at the end of the ceremony, just was like, I think he was close to 90 years old. He was like 88 years old. He was like incredibly impressive, you know, with how he held space through the night. And then as the ceremony came to a conclusion, just the absolute, utter, unacceptable way he had of engaging the young women, and being a woman at that time who was in my late 40s, you know, that's a situation where I really felt my obligation was less to trying to change him, but that I did feel an obligation to supporting the young women in learning how to just turn him away. You know, so I want you, as you're working on that, to also feel yourself in a context of women who are supporting you in coming into more and more both power and liberation in relationship to yourself, that is not something you simply have to do on your own, is I think what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I think that's the support we need, and that's why to me this conversation we had and the difficulty of it because of the tension on this topic as a public discourse,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and the difficulty to just, you know, be able to speak honestly about this and try to hold all the dimensions.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
It is.
And,
it is. It's because,
you know,
it's very vast and complex. Yeah.
It's very vast and complex. And I think we don't want to, you know, it's always a fear of marginalizing someone or,
mm-hmm.
you know, hurting someone unintentionally. But I do think for the purposes of, you know, our greater empowerment as women and in relationship to men, that these are the conversations we need to be having. And I hope men have them as well. You know, I hope men are having these conversations with each other, because we all have deep programming, deep conditioning, you know, patterning. It's also, you know, it can be experienced as shameful, or it can feel really hard to dig into. And that's why we need the support as well as the challenge around it.
And particularly where we're talking about our own relationship to our own sexuality, the way that we wield or don't or ignore our kind of erotic communications, and then how that mixes with power relationships. That's a very complex field of human exchange when sex and power are mixing with one another. And I think, to go back to the beginning of our call, sexual harassment law, to a certain degree, was really trying in a way to create protections against that incredibly confusing mix of dynamics in the workplace. That was sort of the initial idea.
Equal playing field,
of course.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
But, you know, and we know that this stuff shows up even in the most enlightened, you know, quote unquote, spiritual communities, right? I mean, this is everywhere. It's really mm-hmm. deep, difficult stuff. Power and sex, you know, it's pretty basic.
Yeah. Yeah, just throw some money in there, yeah. And then you've really got something. Sex, money, and power,
and then you
really can light up a situation.
Well, I think I just want to reiterate something you said from the chapter, which I really liked. It kind of hit me, and I really liked the way you said it. And then you said that there's a difference between the need to be respected and regarded, and the need to be protected.
Yes,
and that's a really big distinction that I really hadn't thought of until you said it. Mm-hmm. And you said, you know, you followed that with when women externalize power, giving it to men, giving it to policy, giving it to a lawyer or to other women who encourage a position of victimization, we have to ask what part of our own self and capacity we are giving away in the process.
Precisely, yeah.
And I thought that was just beautiful because it's a really hard thing to say, right? But I think you make a really nice distinction there that hit home for me, so.
Yeah, and what I would say is that, you know, it's not that we shouldn't look to policy to create support. You know, it isn't that we, you know, shouldn't look to female mentors and good solid relationships to help us grow, but it is that to the extent that we're abdicating, to the extent that we really are not experiencing ourselves as having agency, we are not accessing a source of power. And that's my biggest concern in this whole, this is where I tend to align with some more of the feminist voices that say, you know, when we put ourselves in relationship to men, always on the receptive end, and therefore always on the potential of being victimized end of the spectrum, we deprive ourselves of a source of power. And, you know, as I said earlier, then with that power comes actually having to be responsible for some of our choices and our, you know, the ways we engage.
And the irony kind of is that choosing to identify as a victim is also another kind of power. It's more indirect.
Absolutely.
You know, but we don't often
Absolutely.
Talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's a very powerful form of power,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah. So I want to finish with one other quote from the book or from the chapter from you that I also liked.
Oh, great.
And I think this ties back into the beginning of what we were talking about, which is, you know, there's going to be these constant fights going on between both sides, the need to find out which facts, you know, who's more to blame, and that's going to continue on in the public discussion. And something, you know, you said resonates with what I feel is what we can do in this moment. And you say it's important to learn to redirect unwanted mm-hmm. sexual energy in a straightforward way. This includes kindness and humor. This is not about protecting mm-hmm. men's feelings. It's about creating a trusting relationship with yourself and increasing your confidence mm-hmm. in navigating relationship challenges. Practicing respect and compassion for ourselves and for others is the best mm-hmm. public policy we've got.
Great.
And I thought that was a great way.
Nicely said.
You know, and I'll tell people we wrote this chapter like 5 years ago, so we're kind of coming back to it after 5 years. The book took a long time.
It's been a
to
long
come
time,
out.
Actually.
So yeah, I feel really great to be able to discuss it more in depth with you, also. And
yeah, me too. I'm happy to kind of be reflecting on it again because we were really, you know, really taking these questions up in an immediate and very vigorous way at the time, and then I've kind of put them down for a little while and have been, you know, working more in other domains. So it's always a good conversation and one that I really appreciate having. And there's just, in a certain way, that, you know, how we learn to engage with respect, with depth, with an open heart, with a sensitivity to cultural context, with a sensitivity to trauma and differences in power and privilege. I mean, there's just no, that is just an important conversation us to continue to have. There's no end to it. You know, it's an ongoing inquiry that, you know, as long as there are differences between men and women, there's this conversation is going to be alive.
Exactly. Exactly. Beautiful. Well, thanks so much, and I look forward to our future conversations on it.
Me too. So let's stay in touch, and we'll see what kind of response people get to the book. And by the way, congratulations to you and Sarah. You guys did a wonderful job pulling this volume together. You've been incredibly patient, and I just want to congratulate you both for doing such a good job with it.
Thank you very much.